How much do we integrate our Shkafa into the Gemara study? Like how much going to Shkafa to Gemara or vice versa? Or how much do we use it as an essential component of like the lumber, like the excellent?
Well, Lomdus has a special methodology. You have to follow that methodology wherever it takes you. So, Lomdus, you know what I mean? You can't predict from Lomdus whether you're going to our stuff or it won't. But you have to simply follow the methodology. But, is that the meaning of your question?
Yeah, so are you saying that the Shkafa, if present, will always be a result of the lumbus and cannot be, should not be seek the other way around? Or not necessarily?
I mean, like when you're learning Gemara, should you...
some people like have the approach to like, you know, like if the Shkafa, if it's there, it'll be like a natural result of the lumbus, and some people will like look for the Shkafa directly and like tie it into the lumbus, let's say.
Well, I mean, you can't do that because when you're learning Talmud, I mean, when you're learning Agada, then definitely it's true. When you're learning Agada, you apply the methodology, so then the Hashkafa is the essence. But that's the difference between Agada and between Talmud. In Talmud, it's the structure of the mitzvah, the logical structure of the mitzvah. Now, sometimes the logical structure ties in with the concept that is of Hashkafic nature. Sometimes, really. But sometimes it does. But that's dependent on following the methodology of the Talmud. But the methodology, when it's applied to Agada, that's really where Hashkafa is.
Like, I don't know, like on the mitzvah, like you look at the Midrashim on it?
Midrashim, Maimari Chazal, different things.
That's like the best way to understand what the Hashkafa is.
Right.
It wouldn't be to go and spend time analyzing all of the structure. And that would be another way.
No. No, like for instance, in Kriya Shema, in mitzvahs, if you study the structure of mitzvahs Kriya Shema, so you'll be studying the lumbus and why it's structured that way. But if you study the Sifri on it, so you'll go into why. What's the essence of Kriya Shema in terms of Hashkafa? In Makom Rishon Avoy Olam. So the Hashkafa really is a separate study.
What if the Hashkafic ideas surface themselves, while you're trying to understand the lumbus and like one feels that they can use it as an essential part of building a lot of structures of, or
what, say again?
So, like what if with a certain sugya, let's say the Hashkafic ideas really seem to surface on the onset, and one feels that they can use it as part of, you know, building the lumbus structures or a lot of structures of the sugya. Is that maybe a time where the philosophical ideas could become part of this idea, or still
thought? I mean, you'd have to see how it works. In other words, when you approach halacha, you're approaching with a certain methodology, and you can't deviate from the methodology. So you have to follow the methodology wherever it takes you. So you can't look at it and say, well, I want to incorporate Hashkafic ideas. I mean, that's if you're doing Agada. Okay, you're doing Chumash Rashi. So then the Hashkafic ideas are of essential role. But when you're learning halacha, there's a certain methodology of halacha which you can't just say, I want to take a Hashkafic idea and push it into this halachic structure. But many times, certain philosophical ideas do emerge from the halacha. A lot of times what emerges from the halacha is the difference between the Torah system and Avodah Zarah. Many times that filters through. Many times. like there's a Rechaimah Halachas Aneres in the Megdash. So he goes through the halachic structure. When you finish, you see that the way we light candles in the Megdash is not like Lahavdil Goyim light candles in the churches. We don't light candles. It's a whole different concept. See? So Hashkafa can come in to the picture, but you can't try to push it in advance. In other words, what you can do is you just follow the structure, and then if it happens to arrive at a point where it sheds light on Hashkafa, so then fine. But you can't initially go with that idea. It's not going to help you if you use that as a guide to unraveling the halacha. I mean, if you see it, you can keep it in mind. But the point is that you still have to follow the rules and the method of the halacha. And wherever it takes you, it takes you. Sometimes it's a counterintuitive, the halacha. Like we're a Mershus Matir, artificial insemination from a guy. So, what are you going to say, Ashkafically? That's telling you that a guy is good to have the offspring of a guy rather than a Jew? No. It's in a specific case with the halachic reason why the artificial insemination take place by a guy. In order to forewarn that a brother should marry a sister, so halacha has a lot of details and causes, and it's not always going to wind up with a hashkafic, beautiful hashkafic conclusion. You know?
Yep. In terms of learning, like I gotta. So what's the best way to, I guess, you know, gain methodology and being able to decipher them?
Well, the best way is the same way as you do on halacha, which is to follow definitively what they're saying. But the problem with agada is that agada many times presupposes a former knowledge. And if it does and you don't have it, and the doors are closed.
You mean a former, like, philosophical knowledge.
Right. See, that's the problem. That's why I mentioned Rav Shmuel Nugget. Okay, he says that if it makes sense to you and if it enlightens you, then it's very good. But if it doesn't, we don't rely on it. What he means by we don't rely on it, he means you don't do things based on Agada. Even though Agada says if you do this and that, it's a good thing, we don't do it unless you understand what it means. That's why many things in Agada we don't do.
But even once, you know, let's say you have philosophical like background, is there any way to gain in terms of, like, you know, getting better at being able to decipher, like, the, you know, the symbols and everything, like, you know, the crown,
symbols?
The intellect, you know what I mean, like, in the different midrashim. You know, like, you're all sitting around in a circle, or whatever it is, like, it seems that the different components of the midrash correspond to different, you know, different ideas or, you know, different things.
Elaborate a little more.
It seems that there are going to be two parts, two steps in deciphering midrash. One is you know, just a prerequisite, which is having the proper philosophical background. That's what you just mentioned.
Right.
Then once you have that, there's taking the midrash and just understanding what it's saying. You know,
okay.
like a midrash. I don't know, like, you know, the ones that the tzaddikim are all sitting around in a circle. You know, in whatever it is, the Lama Ba or the Mashiach.
Right,
right. So is there any, that second step of looking at the Midrash and taking, you know, what the metaphors are, is there any way to get better at doing that?
I mean, the allegory.
Yeah.
See, but the allegory really has to do with the case of previous knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're saying that the allegory is that they are enjoying the Zivashkina and Atrasayim Barashayim, and you have to know what the Atara is and what it represents, And you can't know that unless you really have a profound understanding of what Torah is and what the greatness of Torah is. And so there's a case where you wouldn't understand. You need somebody to give you an eye-opener, like the Rambam says. He explains what the Torah is. That's why you have this Rashba, special Rashba on the Shas, on the Agada of the Shas, where it's important because he brings in many, many points that we don't know. Yes.
I was reading one of the Rebbe's articles online, and it was discussing a symbolism, and it wasn't, I didn't quite understand, like, why what is a symbol, and why do we not have them in Judaism? Like, what exactly is the danger of symbolism?
Well, symbolism is like performing a certain performance out of a primitive type of a behavior, because the symbol is like strikes the mind, not the intellectual mind, but the emotional mind in a certain way, and gives a person a certain sense of security perhaps, or a certain feeling, and we say that we don't know God through emotions, we know God through knowledge. So symbolic activities are not activities based on knowledge, they're based on feelings. Like, for instance, many people by the Seder think you should use an egg, because an egg symbolizes life. See, that's an alien idea. We don't have any ideas about the Torah. Because that's just like giving you an emotional wish for life. That's not not a good thing. It's like it's almost like superstition. Like, because I have this egg on the table, which symbolizes life, so that means that I'm going to have life.
So what's the difference between like there being like, I mean, this mitzvah, it represents this philosophical reason, and saying that like, I mean, is this the question of
right? So we say why? It's gula. It's the idea of gula Hashem. So that's a concept, but it's not symbolic. And even Mora, which is the closest, which is Pesach is Shepasach HaKadosh Baruch Hu HaBalbote HaSeh Mitzrayim, the Korban Pesach, and the concept that the mitzvot, the Asiyas of mitzvot that the Jews were engaged in, really was the reason why they had the Ashgacha. These are all important philosophical principles. And then you have the Mora is the closest one to a symbol, but it's also not a symbol. It's to bring to mind the Merirus and the Avoda Kasha that we will render, from which God removed us, saved us. So it's always ideas about God, His Anhaga, His Hashgacha, His Mitzvos, not to get, symbolic is to get lost in a different world, a world of wishes and emotions. And that's not the Derech HaTorah. See, the Lahavdil Goyim have that. They're very prone to that because it appeases a person in a certain sense. It gives them a sense of wish fulfillment. But that's not really what the Torah is all about. It's a primitive idolatry is always symbolism.
Mm-hmm. So what's an example, just to contrast, like what's something in Judaism that is that really tries to like erase the idea of symbolism, as opposed to like a geisha custom? Like, what would you see an example?
What would be an example?
Right, just like, I mean, of like a geisha custom that really tries to portray a symbol, just so I can get an idea.
Now let me just think. Well, I'd say the Eucharist. The Eucharist is totally symbolic. Where they eat the wafer as the body of the Yeshu, and then they drink the wine, they drink his blood. That's a symbolic, that's a classical symbolic performance. So they want to take the God into themselves. Now that's a very primitive thing, because they used to kill the God every now and then, like once a year or something, and they eat it. It was an animal. they thought that by eating it they gain its strength. So the Eucharist is really a reproduction of the pagan ritual, which is symbolic and which gives them a certain feeling. It's not tied to any ideas. We have tzum. Tzum is concept Yichud Hashem, shmiras on mitzvos, parshiyus of mitzvos, and Yitzias Mitzrayim, and Hashgachas Hashem. These are philosophical concepts. So we don't put on tzum because they're symbolic of anything. They're constructed according to the way the halacha needs to construct them in order to convey the ideas. But not, it's not anything symbolic. Where if you look at it, you'd say, "Wow, this is, this feels right."
Mm-hmm.
It's an important question. It's a good question.
Is it accurate to say that that symbolism is like a representation of an idea that has no reality, like basically like a false idea?
Well. It's, you might say, I mean, it might not be a false idea like life. Like people think that the reason we use the egg is one is echel Pesach, one is echel Chagiga. So it really has nothing to do with life. But people who saw it and have a Christianized mind immediately interpreted it as life. Like springtime, life. So your question is, what's your question again?
So can you say that symbolism is the representation of a false idea?
It's not so much the idea of life is false, it's the idea of how to achieve it and what exactly you mean by it. Mm. I guess life, I mean, what, not every life is worth living. I mean, it's just like life is a life force. See, that's like a symbolic thing. And the feeling that by eating, by having this egg on your table, you're going to be in touch with life, a certain sense. It's a language of the emotions. It's a language, symbolism. Symbolism isn't just it's a language. The language says, I am partaking of life because I have this on my table. I'm partaking of this life, which is a good thing. It's usually pretty vague because once you start defining it, then you need concepts.
It's not organized,
right. Not organized in terms of ideas.
What about on like Rosh Hashanah? You eat like, you know, pomegranate seeds or like stuff like that?
That's a good question. It's not like it's in Gemara whether you do that or not. In Gemara, that's the closest we get. Simna milfi, simna milav milfi. So first of all, the Gemara didn't know whether it is or not. But over there, it's a different question. The question is that, is it good to... Is it good for a person to use a psychological method to give them a certain feeling about the Yom HaDin? See? To remind them of the Yom HaDin. So there's no mitzvah. So you have to use symbolism over there because the only way you could introduce the Yom HaDin into the Suda is by using something that has something to do with the Yom HaDin. But not symbolism. Even there, though, it's not symbolism, because the symbolism, it would be that that eating the honey, or the honey and the apple, would be something that is causing the Yom HaDin. And that we don't believe. We just say that Yirutzon, Yimishbur says, you should be careful not to think that this is going to affect it. So just to remind you of asking God.
Right. Kind of like reflects an idea.
Reflects an idea.
Yeah.
Right. But not that this is a thing that does it. But that's my point, is whether you're allowed to do that. We possibly do. But you see that there was no Masorah on.
I was wondering with the balance, obviously it doesn't apply to me, or just wondering about the idea of, if let's say a Talmud of a Rav is becoming, you know, what's the balance that he should try to concentrate on, like, continuing the Masorah that Rav, you know, that, like, let's say that style of the Rav taught, or on the other hand, you know, really pursuing the, you know, ideas himself and, you know, maybe differentiating from the style somewhat, but
seems like there's a very, there's a, I don't know, in our world, like, there's a very strong, you know, drive to, like, just be, like, the Talmud of, let's say, the Rav, you know, and, like, oh, this is the Rav there. But on the other hand, aren't we just pursuing the truth of ideas, so why should we care what, you know, whether who's representing the Rav in the best way?
That's true, you're absolutely right. You're 100% right. As a matter of fact, the Rav himself would say that he didn't learn like a client. Because a client was inimitable. And even if he were imitatable, we don't believe in imitating somebody. That's not really a method. You gain ideas from a teacher. The Rav one time said, he said, you gain a method from a teacher. The Torah has to be your own Torah. That's what the Rav said. But just to try to reproduce Torah that you think sounds like something the Rav would say, that's not an approach. From the Rav, you gain a method. That's what the Rav used to say on his Tuesday night show. He used to say, if you come here, anyone that comes here can learn an amata, can learn, you say Yiddish, can learn an amatada. Learn a method. And he says, you walk away with a method of learning. That's what you gain. But the Torah, it's very nice to know Torah, and it's very nice to repeat the Rav's Torah. So many times it's very important if you need the points. But that's not your Torah. Your Torah is supposed to be what you gain from learning his method and applying it yourself, not to imitate the Rav's Torah.
What was the difference in how they learned, the Rav and
Rav Chaim? It's different. Rav Chaim was more into abstract, logical, abstract structures, very abstract.
Okay.
The Rav was more into taking an area in Shas and looking at the whole picture, putting the whole picture together.
Wouldn't that be through an abstract conceptual structure?
That's true, but he didn't. His essence wasn't the concentration on. Rav Chaim's abstractions were so abstract that it was a concentration on abstraction. That's why the Rav said that that they liked Rav Chaim when he was younger, better, because at that point he wasn't yet as abstract. But when he got older, people didn't like his Torah because it was too abstract. He couldn't really follow. He couldn't grasp it.
And yeshiva, our methodology is probably more similar to Rav Chaim, right?
Well, in our yeshiva, it was more similar. I would say this, that the what we try to do in our yeshiva is one thing, is to not so much to give fellows Torah, because there's plenty of Torah you can learn yourself. There's a Rav's Torah, there's plenty of Torah. But what we try to do is give a fellow a methodology. We concentrate on that. You see, I don't think that was a Chaim, and I don't think that was the Rav. I don't think that either one of them had that. The Rav said you will get a method, but one time the fellows got a hold of the Rav after Shir, and they asked him to change his style of learning so that they'll be able to gain the method better. To be geared more towards methodology, he refused to do it. He felt, you want to gain methodology, you're on your own. The method is here, it's in there. You find it. So, he didn't, but we don't do that. We try really, we spend time on trying to teach a Talmud how to gain the method and break down, like for instance, when I went to the Rav, so, he would take up an awful lot in a shiur. But for methodology, if you want to just write up everything he said, you're not going to really get too much out of methodology. You'll get a lot of Torah, and it's nice. But if you want to get methodology, you have to concentrate on one point, a point that strikes your mind as an unusual point and a very profound point and a point that you yourself might have missed. And then if you go over in your mind the roots of thinking of how you would approach it, and then you see where you would go, and then you go over his way, and you see where he went, and you try to see why you were distant from the answer. and what you should have done, that's working on methodology. You have more methodology out of one point than you will out of memorizing the entire shiur. So in our yeshiva, we try to concentrate on one thing, giving the fellows the opportunity to gain a methodology. That's what our whole method of learning revolves around.
But in other words, that's in terms of how the Rebbeim and in our yeshiva like give shiur. But I'm saying in terms of like ideally how, let's say, I don't know, you would learn on your own. Would you learn more like the Rav or Rebbeim?
So you can only learn with the given abilities that you have. I mean, the Rav had unbelievable mastery of Shas. So he had a lot of information when he came to a sugya. You know, if you don't have that kind of a mind, encyclopedic comprehensive mind, so then you have to start and then work backwards and work through the Rishonim and put it together slowly. I mean, it's a different. You have to work with what you have. Every person will learn according to the abilities that he has. See, the one time he asked one of the biggest gedolim, the Meitzchi Eibli, he was an unbelievable genius. he went to Lamb Rav Chaim, he was 12 years old. And the fellows who learned with him were in their 30s. And he was just brilliant. One of the fellows that was there wrote over something, Rav Chaim asked a question. And the Meitzchi gave, went through, he had an unbelievable head for Cheshbon. Went through, he took the Gemara Bava Kama and went through like four steps. If it was this, then it would have been like that, and since it's not like that, he went through like four, and he says, that proves, and then that's how we could prove what your question is. So Chaim just stared at him. Just couldn't get over it. But the Meitzchi later in life, when he was asked, do you learn like a Chaim? He said, no. He says, a bad Talmud learns like his Rebbe. He says, a good Talmud is bound by his abilities. So your abilities and your mind really should determine how you learn. Everybody's going to be different. That's why you have one, even in Gedolim, you have one Gedol for this far, another Gedol will have another far. And I don't mean in the same area, even in the same area, but let's say not in the same area. They were all attracted to different areas. It has to do with the structure of the mind. The structure of the mind is very individual. And that's really what you should do. But the methodology is the same. The methodology is always the same. If you listen to the Rav, you'll always hear the same methodology. The Torah is going to be his Torah. You look at the Rav's Torah, and you look at his uncle's Torah. Chazal Breska. You'll see a difference, but not in difference in methodology. But they pick up different things because they're after different things, and their minds are attuned to different things. So that's something that's really what Torah is all about. Just like in the science, just like in mathematics. You have certain mathematicians that developed specific mathematics, and others developed other types of mathematics. It's the mind, it's all mathematics, but it's the mind of the individual which will determine, you know, whether or not they can create a certain type of mathematics. Especially like the non-Euclidean mathematics. So there are different great minds there that develop different systems.
There are some that even created them but wouldn't release them because they thought their mind was wrong.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
How does the schema of Talmud work? How does it kind of get?
Stimus of Talmud?
Yeah.
Well, Stimus of Talmud means that the funny thing is, the one who explains it, the Meitzchi Eibli, has a little bit of an explanation on it. He says that he doesn't believe that people that came later were less intelligent than people that came earlier. He said, for instance, the Rambam and Rav Sajigayan. Because from all that we know, the Rambam was much more intelligent than the greater Chacham than Sajigayan. He says, and Sajigayan lived way before him. So he says it doesn't necessarily mean that a person that lived at an earlier era was brighter than a person that lived at a later date. He says, but why the Chachamim made a stimus of Talmud was because of halachic reasons. Because they didn't want the machlokas to keep on broadening and broadening. They wanted to place a limit because of the halachic system. So they wanted to place a limit on the on how far it can, the you can have your deviations. So they placed limits. That's it. Now nobody's going to buy a row on in this area anymore. It's either like a buy or a row. Can't have another position.
Is it like a gzera?
It's a hora. In other words, the Baalei hora have a responsibility for the system to keep it intact and keep it functioning well. So this is hora on Talmud. In order that the system shouldn't fall apart. Because if you let it keep on expanding, or in machlokes, you can have 15 different ways eventually. You can't do it. You have enough machlokes. And then you have machlokes in the fixed machlokes in the Talmud, you have machlokes later in those machlokes in itself. So they didn't want it to spread apart before. I don't know if they anticipated all the machlokes occurring that way.
Is that the same thing that's going on when the Amorim don't argue with the Tanaim?
Same thing.
So, like, let's say Amora has, like, let's say he just doesn't like either of their positions. The point is that he can't paskin against one of those two?
That's right.
But, like, on his own, he could theoretically have a third?
Yeah, theoretically, he has right to theorize. If he just wants to theorize in Torah, he certainly has right to do that. But he can't proclaim it as a legitimate position in halacha.
Yeah. Why don't we see? You don't see that like in the Amoraim or in the Rishonim, just because they're always writing halachas.
Right.
Work.
Right. The only thing they recorded was things that are not gel halacha. They didn't just record theoretics that they kept to themselves. Gemara is mine afkamina. Because the objective has to be certain. The objective in halacha has to be asiyah. Shmiras adin, shmiras halacha. There's no reason to go, you want to do abstract work, you can do abstract work in many areas. You know what I mean? You don't have to limit yourself to Talmud.
You mean there would be no purpose of doing that type of study?
There would be no purpose unless the person thought that the Torah really means something else, something other, which is a very beautiful idea.
Right.
Then they, occasionally you do find like a chronos say, Valuli de Mistafina. And they'll say their own idea. You know? Because they think it's a beautiful idea, and it's true in their minds, even though you can't argue on a Rishon, but nevertheless, it's a beautiful idea and should be brought out. And over there, it could be true. But you don't find that in the Talmud itself. Yes.
Why did the Rambam reject the position of Yisur Mishalava? Like, what exactly is, like, why is that position so illogical?
That's a good question.
But it also seems like some of the Gaonim also, like, they were influenced by, he brings down a third group of Arab philosophers that held this position.
What the hell do I want?
Right, they're like a Yisurim Shalava, that you can never know evil until the end of your life. So to say something is bad would be illogical. So I mean, that seems like a pretty.
Because you don't know what it's going to eventuate.
Right. You know. So like, what's so illogical about the position of the Rambam rejected it?
I guess for the same reason the Rambam rejected the idea of Nisoyon, like the Ramban interprets Nisoyon. Like the Nisoyon for Avraham Avinu to do the Akedah Yitzchak. So the Ramban says that Nisoyon really improved him. And by coming through it properly, he emerged a different person. The Rambam doesn't believe that. The Rambam believes he was the same person before, same person afterwards. The only reason that the Nisayon was given to him was to demonstrate something to mankind. So it would seem that the Rambam maintains that in order to attain perfection, you don't need Yisurim. You don't need Yisurim. You need Yisurim if you go off the track as an onesh in order to put you back on the track. But then everybody agrees in Yisurim. That's because of chait. And chait also will bring on Yisurim. But the Rambam did not believe that God gives a person Yisurim in order to perfect them, because he held that perfection does not require pain. The road to perfection is a method and an approach and a system, and you don't need to be pained. You shouldn't be in a state of pain in order to perfect yourself. That state is not a good state, according to the Rambam. Plato held it like this as well. Plato held that neither pain nor pleasure is a good state for the soul to attain perfection, because it's too involved. It takes away the energies.
Is there anything deeper machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban on Nisayon? Like, would the Rambam say it makes no sense that somebody... Like, would either the Rambam say that the Nisayon like that makes no sense, or would you just say the system doesn't work like that?
The Rambam just didn't hold, that the system is such that Avraham Avinu has to suffer in order to perfect himself. That's not the way it is. But the others argue, and they say that in certain instances, and it's a good, I don't know who's right, I mean, talking about right. The one holy essential law, but they hold that in certain instances it's necessary. It's necessary to bring out a certain point in a person's life. Who's right, I don't know.
According to the Jesus, that Yisurin Shalaba exists. So, does that mean that a person is supposed to look at the Yisurin and somehow take something from the Yisurin itself, or just start reflecting in general once Yisurin comes?
Well, that certainly, the Gemara always says you should always reflect in general, because you don't know if it's Yisurin Shalaba, first of all. Right? But Yisurin Shalaba are such that the person sees that these Yisurin are directing him in a certain, enlightening him in a certain way, which is important for a soul.
And meaning you should learn something you're trying to tell.
Right.
Like a meter, can I mean that type of thing?
Yeah. Sometimes.
How does he know when it's Yisurin Shalaba, when it's just nature?
That's a tough one. I mean, all the Gemara says is Yifashesh Masa, and he should check himself out and see if if the Yisurin are because of certain chayit, and then if he can't find that, he could be, and he's on a high level. It's a high level of Ashgacha to have Yisurin Shalaba. But the Gemara says that the Chazal didn't want it. Lo hein v'lo skaran.
They all like the Rambam.
It's an interesting response, because they seem to hold there is such a thing, but they didn't want it. Lo hein v'lo skaran. Not worth it. I guess they felt that the Yisurim are too powerful, and they take them away from learning. It's an interesting question, even though I don't know how to think of that. Why, if they believe that it's for the good, so why did they say they don't want it? Lo hein v'lo skaran. Something to think into. Unless they held that they could perfect themselves, like you said, like the Rambam, that they could perfect themselves without Yisurin also. But you have to think into it. My Maharaj has all very deep. Okay, very good questions. Take one more, or that's it? Yeah.
Why don't we do in Yeshiva the Rambam's division of the Shri Shri Torah, Shri Shri Torah, Shri Shri Torah, Shri Shri Torah.
Why we don't do that?
Yeah.
You see, the real start in Europe, because the thing is that really, that's the right way to do it. But the only thing is that you could always learn Tanakh, and once you get the method of learning, the key, you can learn anything. And if you don't, so then you can't learn anything properly. So therefore, in the yeshivish world, what they did was they concentrated on lumdus. Because they thought a person goes in the yeshiva a certain amount of years. If he walks away with the derech and learning, he could always learn Tanakh. But if you're going to spend time in the yeshiva learning Tanakh and you're going to be missing out on the derech and learning, then you're always going to be shallow the rest of your life. So because of the fact that we don't put in that many hours in our lifetime, like the Rambam says his whole life has to be 9 hours of learning, 3 hours of 3-3-3. I mean, we don't do that. Usually the person goes to work and they can't afford to do that much time. So he's conveyed to the Torah, but he's not doesn't have that much time. So the main thing is to get the derech, and then you can do anything. In other words, the amount of years, every few years in yeshiva, the best thing is to concentrate on the derech halim. Because then you walk away with the tools. Once you have the tools, you can apply it to anything. Okay?
If one is learning, like, say, like, by himself, like on a Sunday at home, and he has certain amount of hours set up to learn by himself, should he do it splitting up the day, or can he still learn the entire day Gemara?
Well, it depends. If he's going to be learning deeply, so insofar as he could be learning deeply analytically, he should learn analytically. But if he's not, then he should learn Tanakh, he should learn ideas. Is there a bit of time that says when we learn Gemara, you're Mekayim all three. But you have to learn a lot of Gemara, and you have to look up all the Pesukim.
In the
time to read.
So why is the system set up like that to begin with? I mean, why don't we just say when a person has had to learn the Ian with that far, then he should learn that, and when he doesn't, he should learn the Kiyas.
Why what?
I mean, why do we say, ideally, a person, why is there a concept of splitting up 3-3-3? Why don't we just say when a person is able to sit down and learn deeply, then he should do that, and when he's not, then he should learn
the Kiyas.
Kiyas, yeah.
We do.
So, what's the concept in the Gemara of splitting up?
Oh no, because if you follow the order of the Gemara, first you do Torah Shabbos, and then you do Mishnayos, and Ligmar Inish V'Ado Lizbar. First, you should first finish the whole areas of Torah, and then you should go and analyze it. Because analysis should be when you have all the facts in front of you. So first of all, in those days you had to do that because you didn't have any sources. But today, if you take a Gemara, so you have Rishonim bring down the sources, so you could be analytical through their bekeis. So you can't do it. In the old days, you couldn't do it. Lizmar in a shada v'ada lizmar. First person has to finish the material, then it has nothing to analyze otherwise. So even with the Rishonim, it would still be most ideal if a person could learn through and grasp all of Shas in his mind first. And then analyze. But first of all, you're talking about a certain type of mind that can do that. Not every mind has such a good memory and such a photographic grasp of the terrain of the Talmud. So, for all intents and purposes, the method in the yeshiva is really the best method. And like I said, you're not really that handicapped. You are, because you'd still be better off if you came to the Gemara with the knowledge that the Rav had when you came to the Gemara. But even if you don't, you have the Rishonim bring in all the pertinent areas. So through them, you're able to make up for the loss of not having the Bekiyas. But Bekiyas is important for another reason. And this is a matter of for younger fellows, for Regilas. In other words, because you have to become a Regil in the method of reading the Talmud. So it's not just Bekiyas for the sake of gaining facts, but it's Bekiyas for the sake of being able to learn a piece of Gemara properly. You know what I mean? So that's important. That's why I think a guy in the yeshiva should learn at least 30, 50 blot a year. So at least you'll pick up, because you could be the biggest Talmud Chacham, you could have the greatest mind, but you can't read the Rashi straight, you can't read the Taisa straight, then you you're building on sand. That's what the Rebbe used to say. If I don't know a Torah, I can sleep at night. But if I don't know Pshat in the Ramban, he says I can't. Of course, the Pshat is very important. Even though the Lumdus is the beauty of it, but you must know Pshat. So you've got to spend time in the Bikiyas in order to gain facility in the textual interpretation of the time. That's important. Okay, Rabbi Frey. Good question.